From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
The rise of the sharing economy. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Welcome to what's called collaborative consumption with internet companies like Airbnb, Relay Rides, Liquid Space, and TaskRabbit. They're providing access to things you want without the burden of ownership. Cars, houses, tools, garage space, even leftover food. They're building a marketplace that's already worth $26 billion, reducing waste and throwing a scare into businesses based on consumption. But what about safety, regulation, and trust? Is this the future or only a fad? Today's talking point, baseball cracks down on drug use big time. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. The consumer economy is facing a challenge from what's called the sharing economy, a new way of introducing people who own things to people who need to use them. Will new internet companies disrupt traditional patterns of doing business, or will they just fade away? We'll talk about that. Today's talking point, three-time MVP Alex Rodriguez is just one of the big-name baseball stars facing fines and suspensions in Major League Baseball's latest drug crackdown. First, this news update. The State Department has issued a worldwide travel alert, and it's closing dozens of U.S. embassies and consulates this Sunday in the Middle East and in Africa. The actions are based on what's described as potential terrorism planned by al-Qaeda and its affiliates. Siobhan Gorman is intelligence reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you.
This travel alert is all for the entire month of August.
Yes, it is. I think that's actually a kind of a standard time frame for these warnings, though.
So there's also the closing of the diplomatic facilities. Is that just on Sunday, or will there be more after that?
It's hard to know. So far, the only one that we've been told about is just on Sunday. So, and those are in areas where the embassies would otherwise have been open on Monday because of the work week in the Middle East.
Is it difficult to conduct diplomacy and international relations without those facilities?
Probably not for just a day. I mean, these are people who are able to communicate otherwise, but it does suggest a certain severity to the threat. Although, one administration official I was speaking with this morning said that this is sort of a mid-range level of threat. It's not the kind of thing that has people's hair on fire at this point, but it's also not something that you can just ignore.
Obviously, the facilities might be targets. What about the travelers, and what danger is there to them, and where?
Right. Well, the where is actually the really tricky question. The warning yesterday was against embassies. The threat, as far as I've been told, is both against U.S. diplomatic facilities in the region, but also some other possible U.S. interests overseas, which could include private sector entities like airplanes and things like that. And the travel warning that was put out today strongly suggested that this was a threat emanating from the Arabian Peninsula, which would be al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is al-Qaeda's Yemen affiliate. And we do know that they have a penchant for trying to put bombs on airplanes. And so that is a reasonable thing to think that they might be looking at.
Are there any specific places that Americans are being told not to go?
Not at this point, no. They're told to monitor, country warnings and things like that. But this was a more general warning that was put out in light of the kind of growing intelligence about this potential threat in the Middle East and North Africa.
What's the nature of the intelligence?
That has been a little bit hard to discern. The best information I've been given so far is that intelligence analysts have seen an increase in so-called chatter. So when, they kind of have a baseline sense of terrorists that they're tracking and what they talk about and when and how. And sometimes they'll see, you know, an intensifying set of discussions about things that suggest that there may be some kind of plot underway. Part of the challenge here is it doesn't sound like the information is specific enough to truly understand what the target is.
So it's hard to know how seriously to take this when you have one source saying that this is sort of a mid-level threat, but on the other hand, the actual actions that are being taken are pretty severe.
Right. Well, it may be that we're seeing a heightened sensitivity, especially in the wake of the attack on the U.S. consulate or diplomatic facility in Benghazi, that it may be that State Department, you know, now has, you know, a lower threshold for the kinds of information that would prompt it to put out a warning, too. So it that also makes it a little bit hard to judge how severe this threat is. Like I was told, right now it's considered kind of a mid-range threat.
And I gather there are also some anniversaries coming up having to do with the bombings that took place 15 years ago in Tanzania and in Kenya?
Yes, there's that anniversary as well as the end of Ramadan. So there could be a number of you know, reasons on the calendar that we would be concerned about this particular time period.
So, again, the diplomatic facilities are being closed. There's a traveler's alert. We're concerned about bombs on airplanes. What about resorts in the areas involved?
Well, there's also a warning against resorts and places where American travelers might congregate. Certainly in the past, there have been plots or successful bombings of resorts and things like that overseas. So those kinds of things are natural concerns that counterterrorism officials would look toward.
Does this mean longer lines at airports for international travelers?
Not clear yet. We're querying the Homeland Security Department about that right now. One might think that at some point, if this threat persists, we could start to see that filtering out to airport security as well.
And back to the facilities that are being closed down, I understand even the embassy in Israel is being closed on a Sunday. That's a pretty important place.
It is, although the indications we've been given so far is that there isn't any sort of direct threat to U.S. U.S. operators in Israel. However, you know, it is within the region that is, you know, a part of this terrorist threat concern.
Okay. And the chatter that you're talking about, I take it, comes from the interception of phone calls and other kinds of communications.
Yeah. I mean, it can be the interception of phone calls. It can also be human sources. And I haven't been able to get the specifics as to the particular nature of that kind of chatter. But often it's kind of a combination of both, because our intelligence agencies have a bunch of different ways of monitoring terrorist planning.
Siobhan Gorman, intelligence reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Many thanks.
Thank you.
In a moment, the rise of the sharing economy on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Sharing resources is a practice as old as the human species. Renting is nothing new. But what's called the sharing economy is based on a combination of things, the Great Recession and smartphone technology. And it's now playing to a tune of $26 billion. Derek Thompson is senior editor of The Atlantic, where he oversees business coverage for TheAtlantic.com. It's good to have you on our program.
Hi, it's good to be here.
This all started in San Francisco, and there are those who say it sounds sort of hippy-dippy, but when you're talking about $26 billion, you're beyond that realm, it would seem.
It does, I think, strike a lot of people as hippy-dippy for people to share things as expensive as cars and houses, essentially, to get out of the need to buy them. But one of the amazing things about the Internet and about having the Internet on us at all times with mobile phones is that it allows people to make use of otherwise idle inventory. So, like you said very well, I think the sharing economy is this group of newish companies that allow people to share and access goods that you used to have to buy, so cars, bikes, clothes, appliances. It's also called the collaborative consumption movement, or the peer-to-peer economy. And the idea behind it, sort of from an economic perspective, is that every day, you know, food goes stale and cars just sit in driveways and clothes get thrown in the trash, empty rooms stay empty. And, you know, it occurs to, I think, a lot of business people, not hippies, but business people, that you can build an enterprise around making better use of this idle inventory and charge people for essentially sharing what they already have.
Tell us about some of the companies involved.
Right. So I think probably one of the most famous is Airbnb, which allows people to share their rooms. You also have Zipcar, which allows people, I guess you're not sharing the car with somebody else. It's not peer-to-peer so much as Zipcar owns the cars, and then it tells you which cars are free. You can take them for a quick drive. And then you never actually own the car. You simply have a kind of subscription. It's the same with Capital Bike Share. Capital Bike Share in Washington, D.C., there's also a bike share program in New York and some other cities, allows people to have a bike whenever they want it, when they walk to a station and they hop on a bike and they put in a little pin and they ride away and then park it somewhere else in the city. They don't actually own a bike. They own zero bikes potentially, but they can ride a bike whenever they want. And that's sort of the upside of this movement, is it allows access without ownership.
You mentioned Zipcar, where the company owns the cars, but what about relay rides, where, in fact, people get together who own cars with those who need rides?
Right. It's a sharing economy. I think you can think of it as two ways. There's some peer-to-peer companies where they allow people to share things that are owned. So, for instance, if I have a room and I'm not going to be in it for the next 2 weeks, I can go onto Airbnb and I can try to rent it out. And Airbnb makes that process possible and makes it easy. Or there's a system where it's the company that owns everything. The bike share company owns the bikes, Zipcar owns the cars, and we simply pay to access those cars without ever owning them.
What's TaskRabbit?
Right. TaskRabbit is there's a couple really cool little companies that essentially allow us to pay for people's time. So if I need my taxes done, or if I need some expenses done, or I need a little bit of research, rather than hire somebody, an assistant, I can pay explicitly for the amount of time that it takes for them to achieve this task. So I hire somebody to do some really simple task, and then they do it, and I pay them for that task. It's a sort of combination of the sharing economy and another movement we've seen accelerate through the Great Recession, this rise of freelance work.
Derek Thompson, again, senior editor at The Atlantic. Milo Yiannopoulos is a founder and editor of the online tech magazine The Kernel, which relaunches on August 12th. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You, as I understand it, are a skeptic about this.
Yeah, I am. I mean, I find a lot of the language used to be very woolly. I mean, we just heard about a couple of companies that could only be described as rental. When you look at the sort of Silicon Valley marketing spiel that's used to describe these sort of incredible collaborative sharing things, what you realize, in fact, is that, money is being made here, but it's not being made by, anybody with assets to share. It's being made by the companies themselves. And they're certainly not sharing the profits that they're making, in some cases, pretty vast ones, through people sharing this. It's difficult to know where to begin, really. Once you cut out the businesses that are just very, very traditional rental businesses from the supposed sharing economy, some of the numbers people throw around, like, X number of billion, very quickly becomes a couple of Silicon Valley startups, none of whom, behave particularly well. These companies can lead to very dangerous things. Airbnb has prostitutes in people's living rooms, put drug addicts in people's living rooms. Car sharing services allow people to drive unlicensed and uninsured because the key cards can be shared between friends, and that's a huge PR disaster waiting to happen. And then, of course, there's the politics of it. There's the sort of guilt mongering. This idea that we should be, and you see this implicitly in a lot of the marketing of these businesses, this idea that we are consuming too much. I don't see any shame in enjoying the fruits of our labor, the fruits of globalized capitalism. If everybody wants to cars, that's fine by me. But there's a nasty veneer of sort of guilt mongering around a lot of these companies, which I don't like either.
Let me go back to Derek Thompson with The Atlantic. What about guilt mongering?
Right. Well, I would say two things. One, people do make money from Airbnb. It's not just the capitalists at the top. It's also the peers. If I choose to rent out my room, I have a choice. I can say, all right, I'm going to be gone from my house for 2 weeks on vacation. I won't rent my room, and I won't make a couple $100. Or I will rent it, and I will make $200. And so there's obvious profit to be made there that's given to me and not to the capitalists at the top of Airbnb. Second, the idea that Airbnb has allowed prostitutes and drug addicts into people's living rooms, these have been really, really isolated incidents. instances. It's absolutely the case that that these companies have a PR element to look out for, and that's why they're very, very careful, a lot of them, about making sure that the peer-to-peer economy doesn't become some sort of awful anarchy. But, you know, all sorts of horrible things happen in hotels, too. There have been prostitutes and drug addicts that go to hotels, and awful things that have happened in hotels that have been bad for that PR, but it hasn't destroyed the hotel industry. People just realize that sometimes when you do business with people that you don't know, which is the nature of business, you're going to have some unintended consequences. And I do think that, you know, we're in the early years of these, you know, rental, peer-to-peer, collaborative consumption, whatever you want to call them, companies, and they're going to have growing pains, but I do think that they stand to make quite a big difference in a lot of big industries, in particular for Airbnb, the hotel industry.
What about the pitch, Derek Thompson, about waste and getting rid of waste and saying that we consume too much? Milo Yiannopoulos says he's not feeling guilty about that.
Yeah, and that's fine. Right. I mean, we're a consumption economy. We wouldn't have anything like a modern economy if we didn't spend as much as we do. But I think the question is, you know, what are we going to spend it on? Does it make sense for somebody struggling with a mortgage and with health insurance? Do they have to buy a car? Should we force them to buy a car? Or should we allow them to use a company like Zipcar or another car-sharing company that allows them to access the beautiful faculty of driving along the roads to get somewhere without actually paying $30,000 and all of that gas in order to do it? I think what the sharing economy allows is a more efficient use of resources. And that's actually, that's not uncapitalist. That's the heart of capitalism. Making more efficient use of resources and using technology to do so has been the heart of capitalism for centuries. And that's exactly, I think, what the sharing economy allows us to do.
Milo Yiannopoulos, what do you say to that?
I'm not completely persuaded by that for one main reason, which is that what we're doing with the sharing economy is we're undermining the importance of the big consumer purchases that we make. These choices that are the way that we explain who we are to the world. They're the way that we signal to other people the kinds of human beings we are. And private cognitive and physical space is essential to good psychological hygiene, and those spaces are being eroded all the time. If you look at the way that Silicon Valley is pushing us to share more of our private lives, and now they want us to share our physical possessions too. And one of my worries, I guess, with this is that actually, property rights are pretty much the basis of our society. The things you own do say a lot about you. And to me, it's a quite important part of a cognitive process of coming into learning who you are, the sorts of objects and things you choose to surround yourself with, the sorts of signals that you send to other people. And one by one, all of these private spaces, these spaces that are so essential for good psychological hygiene, have been eroded by Silicon Valley companies who, yes, absolutely do pay people for the shared use of their things, but they pay themselves a lot more. And if you look at any of these systems, I mean, eventually they fail to reach sufficient critical mass because consumers realize that they're not making nearly as much money as they should be, and they're not making nearly as much money as the companies providing the services. So I have some problems with it that if you want to have a discussion about capitalism, I mean, I think it's just as strong an argument on the other side to suggest that one of the reasons it won't work, and one of the reasons it's troubling, is that it is undermining the nature of these big purchases, a house, the car, which is so essential to an understanding of personal identity.
April Rennie is Chief Strategy Officer at the Collaborative Lab. That's a strategic advisory firm working with companies and governments, we'll talk about that in a moment, around the world to understand the potential of collaborative consumption. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
What do you say to the argument that this is eroding the nature of our private lives, the physical possession, the need for possessions that is so important to people's identity and a threat to psychological hygiene?
Yeah, this is just a delightful debate. So diving right in, I think one of the things that's most important to keep in mind is that sharing is one of the oldest behaviors known to mankind. What we're doing today is not necessarily that new. Going back to even caveman time and village time, the village was the original sharing platform, and we can even look at cities today as really hardwired for sharing. So what we're doing through collaborative consumption and the sharing economy and the collaborative economy of modern day is we're taking the power of technology and harnessing that to enable different kinds of sharing on a scale and in ways never before possible. So I don't think, to Derek's point, we're not forcing this on anybody. We're not saying that all things have to be shared. There are plenty of things in the world that aren't amenable to sharing. But for those that are, where we want access to the good or service, rather than needing or wanting to own it outright, we're looking at a much broader way of transacting, of sharing wealth, of creating value, and in effect baking a bigger pie as opposed to seeing the pie as finite and carving it up differently.
Talk a little more about the scale. Milo Yiannopoulos was skeptical about the $26 billion figure we've heard about so often and said often when you get down to it, it's really just a couple of Silicon Valley startups.
Yeah, well, a couple of different ways I want to take that. So at Collaborative Lab, we work, as I mentioned, globally. And we work through a network. We have presence in more than 26 countries. We've worked on every continent except for Antarctica. And we've worked with established companies, with startups, and again with governments. And what we can say is there is massive activity happening around the world. Now, what's really interesting is that a lot of it is not big, keeping in mind that the sharing economy, and when we talk about the economic and environmental and importantly the community and social benefits of collaborative consumption, we're talking about them at a hyper-local level. So what I would point out is there are actually thousands of companies, initiatives, ways that individuals and corporations are integrating collaborative consumption principles into their business. They're not all built for scale. Ironically, I would say, it's not that we want everything to be at massive global scale. I think Airbnb, in many respects, fantastic company, in my opinion. It is more of an exception than the rule, because a lot of sharing economy companies also got started as not a backlash, but as an alternative to large corporations. So the nature or the fact that they wouldn't be big makes sense, but what we need to look at is the network effect of a lot of small companies in a lot of cities and a lot of countries in the world, and what that creates at a global level is rather extraordinary and very powerful, even though it's not all contained on one budget sheet.
So is the $26 billion figure then justifiable, do you think? Isn't it awfully difficult to add up all of these rather small activities that you're talking about to reach that big a number?
So it's hard to come up with the data and the numbers, to your point, around how disaggregated some of the activity is. One thing I do want to draw out here, though, is to note that what we've been talking quite a lot about and where a lot of the power and the publicity has been is in those platforms and companies that are monetizable, where if you're staying in my home or I'm renting you my car, you're paying me something for that. But let's keep in mind also that when we talk about the sharing economy writ large and the larger value spectrum, there are monetizable models and also non-monetizable models. And that's where, if you think about, an easy example is looking at Airbnb and couch surfing. And Airbnb, obviously, you're charging, you're getting paid, the company is taking a small commission from that. But then couch surfing is based on the principle of reciprocity. So you will never actually pay to couch surf in someone else's home. And the assumption and expectation is that other couch surfers, when they're visiting your town, will stay with you for free when you're able. So right there, I would ask people, I often have this debate with others around what's the value in that. It's not showing up in terms of couch surfing's annual revenues, but there's an enormous value that's monetary as well as community and social and environmental in that.
We need to take a break. Couch surfing has only recently come up. We'll come back and find out what that is. On our talking point today, Major League Baseball cracks down on drugs big time. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the sharing economy. Is it worth $26 billion? Is it anything more than just renting? Will it, in fact, have an impact on the consumer economy? We're talking now with April Rinney, a chief strategy officer at the Collaborative Lab, which works worldwide to help governments and companies understand collaborative consumption, as it's called. When you said couchsurfing, were you talking about a company or just the practice of company sharing the couch that so many people do?
No, it's actually the company, couchsurfing.com, and they've got, I believe, 7+ million members worldwide. And it's a global network. They're in, I think, close to 200 countries.
What do they do?
So they basically provide the platform for, and that's, you know, by and large what these companies are about. And as Derek mentioned, too, it's not that Couchsurfing, the company, owns any of the assets or the inventory, but they use digital technology to create platforms for people around the world to connect with one another. And so on Couchsurfing, you know, you're traveling to a city, you tap into the platform, you need to be a member, and then you are connected to other couch surfers in that community. And basically, it's almost like an informal poll or survey when you reach out to others where you'd like to stay and who's available and can host you at that time.
Again, April Rinney with the Collaborative Lab. Anna Bernasek is the author of The Economics of Integrity. She writes the Data Points column at the New York Times. Anna, good to have you on our program.
Hi, very happy to be here.
Earlier on in the program, the issue was raised of how do you know who you're dealing with when you're engaged in the sharing economy. And I think Milo Yiannopoulos, our dissenter here, said that he was concerned that you don't know who you're dealing with when you just go on an app of this kind. Although we did hear from Derek Thompson that there are efforts to, get people to get background checks and so on. What's the importance here of trust, and is that a new element in the sharing economy?
I think trust is essential to the sharing economy, but I would argue that trust is essential to our capitalist economy. So in a sense, we aren't really talking about anything new here. We're talking about what is the critical ingredient that creates wealth in our market economy, and that's trust. And so, you know, when we tend to think about our economy as based on self-interest, and that's the sort of the fundamental point we take out of Smith. But Smith had another big idea.
Adam Smith, the economist.
Adam Smith, right. And his other big idea about how we create wealth is how we cooperate together. And those are two ingredients, and we tend to always focus on self-interest, and we neglect how we cooperate to create wealth. And I think the sharing economy is something that we take for granted in our broader economy, but I think it's highlighted in these new companies that are out there, and we can't ignore the sharing factor.
So you think then that this is not, in that sense, then, anything new? It's just an extension of what we already do?
It's an extension and an enabler. What the web is doing is creating enormous efficiencies. But in a sense, no, the fundamentals of trust, are the same. I mean, you can rent out your home by putting an advertisement in the paper, for somebody to come and rent out a room for the weekend, or you can do it on the web, which is faster and more efficient. You can reach more people. In a sense, perhaps, the trust factor is more important, though, in that perhaps you would interview people face-to-face before you rented out your room, whereas on the web, you're going to be saying, okay, yes, I'll rent my room to you, and you don't actually know that person. But what is developing and what we see developing on the web is mechanisms to increase trust. And so, for instance, when eBay first started, there weren't really mechanisms in place to really ensure trust. But as the company developed, they introduced, interesting features, which today we take for granted. But one, for instance, is the rating system. And that's a really fundamental way to get people to trust in who they're dealing with on the Internet.
How does the rating system work, though, and how can we be sure who, in fact, is doing the ratings and it's not, in fact, whatever entity is that it is that's being rated?
Right. The thing is, Warren, how can you be sure about anything in the economy? So I just want to make that point, first of all. I mean, you know, you can go to the corner store and buy a gallon of milk, but can you really be sure that the milk is not affected in any way, or that it wasn't sort of left out and not treated in the way it should have been treated, so when you get it, it's actually old and spoiled? Do you know what I mean? So in a sense, you're never going to be 100% sure, but the reason why our economy works so well is that, you know, we're sort of like 95, 96, 97% sure. So in that sense, I think that we really do have a sort of a good system for creating trust.
Anna Bernasek again at the New York Times. Back to Milo Yiannopoulos at the online tech magazine The Kernel. What do you say to that? Is this then fundamentally all that different from the way the economy works now, given the importance of trust, whether it's a bank or a milk company or whatever else?
No, I mean, it's super simple. The reality is that we can't trust other people, which is why we have this thing called regulation. And regulation exists to, you know, to protect the relationships, because fundamentally we can't rely on other human beings or other corporations to act even in their own best interest, let alone in ours. So in industries like travel and tourism, let's take the hotel industry and Airbnb as an example. These are industries that are relatively heavily regulated, and they're regulated to protect consumers. They're regulated to ensure companies. And let's take the question of Uber, for example, which is a company that has enjoyed butting up against regulation in every city that it's expanded out to. Why do these regulations exist? They exist to protect people. At these sort of upstart Silicon Valley companies who, in their unending arrogance, presume that they can transform the world by building a platform on the internet, come in and say, we no longer need, you know, all of this regulation nonsense. It's just protecting entrenched interests. We're going to disrupt it, as they like to say. What do? They open up the space for the sorts of things I talked about earlier, which are not that fringe, by the way. If you talk to, as a journalist, I kind of get a lot of people come to me with ugly stories that I have to look into and decide whether or not to pursue. And those Airbnb prostitute and drug addict stories that you hear about, well, they are precisely that, the ones you hear about. And the company's got a lot better recently of closing these stories down before they reach the public. You know, basically throwing people cash and apologies and begging them not to go to the press. But there was a period when the company was handling them extremely badly, and that those were the ones you heard about. So actually, you know, I'm not convinced that they're getting any safer. I'm not convinced these companies have the essential role of regulation. We've seen, you know, we've seen what happens when you deregulate. We've seen it in a big way with the global economy.
Anna Bernasek, let me go back to Anna Bernasek and get a comment from her on your point. Go ahead.
I guess I don't have any issue with regulation if it's done correctly. I mean, I'm a great athlete. I love sport. And sport is all about, you know, the rules of the game. I mean, it's essential. And in the market, it's essential to have the rules of the game so that you know how to create wealth. So regulation, I don't know, it's got such a dirty word, but, you know, if it's done correctly, if it's done right, it actually creates and enhances economic activity. So, yeah, sure, in certain areas we do need effective regulation, and that's just the way the market works best, quite frankly.
Do you agree then with Mr. Yiannopoulos that we can't really rely on each other even to act in our own best interests, and we need regulation for that?
No, I think fundamentally people are good and people want to do the right thing. I think there's always one or two or a small minority of people who are going to do the wrong thing. But you don't want to create an economy and rules to try and just catch those people out and penalize everybody else. I think it's much better to think of a system where you create rules to set people free to do the right thing. And we have those kind of rules and we can do more of that stuff. And so I think that that's the way that we need to be thinking about for the future.
So we've got Hobbes versus Locke here on this program. April Rennie, back to you at the Collaborative Lab. You deal with governments as well as companies around the world. Tell us some of the issues that have arisen. I know, for example, here in Los Angeles and elsewhere in the country, the rideshare people have run into trouble with the taxicab companies.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And really, when we look at the policy issues, first you need to kind of look at the vertical or the sector, because there's quite a difference between the needs of shared accommodation, shared space versus shared transportation versus things like financial services or new forms of education, all of which collectively in some way do factor into the sharing economy. So I would say that, you know, the main issues that we see arise in the case of transportation, it's a whole lot around insurance. In accommodation, you have also insurance, but you also have things like zoning. So from a city's perspective, too, what we're trying to do is create a thrivable, shareable city, if you will, for those cities that want to embrace this kind of economic activity. And then you've also got different kinds of lobbying efforts, and that, again, looks very different depending on where in the world you are, but that can relate to licensing and certification. That can relate to, you know, how different assets and resources are treated by a particular municipality and so forth. It's a really, really interesting space with a huge amount of opportunity, because what I would just draw on here is that most of the laws and regulations and rules of the game that exist today were constructed around the world during an era that was much more about ownership. It was from the Industrial Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. So we built those rules, and now what we find is, by and large, it's not that they're bad necessarily, but they're very awkward and clumsy when applied to a shared situation.
What about insurance? You mentioned insurance. So what happens if you're a Airbnb a client and you get hurt because of some a problem in the place that you have rented out for the moment? Or what happens if you're a rideshare a person and you're riding in somebody's car and an accident occurs? Who's responsible? And do these companies that Mr. Yiannopoulos says are making too much money on this offer insurance?
They sure do, by and large. So Airbnb has a $1 million policy with Lloyd's. So you're insured up to $1 million, depending upon the value of what happens in your property and so forth, but it's a $1 million policy. Zipcar, when you sign up to be a member of Zipcar, you're covered by their insurance policy when you're in a Zipcar. Relay Rides, same thing. Relay Rides now has nationwide insurance coverage that covers you when you're in a car. It's part of the benefits of membership, and it's part of the fee that you pay to Relay Rides to actually benefit from tapping into this inventory of vehicles. So most of the companies, certainly those that are larger to scale, are very aware of what's going on here. Oftentimes, especially in the transportation space, it can take a lot of time and resources to put in place the right policy. And what's interesting is we also have worked with some insurance companies that are really trying to get their heads around this space, because it's very new, but it's also a whole new opportunity for business development and looking at insuring people and items on a use basis, as opposed to one person, one unit, all or nothing kind of coverage.
Let me go back to our first guest, Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees business coverage for TheAtlantic.com. Are these some of these sharing companies, not perhaps the ones we just heard about, trying to avoid regulations? Is that one of the costs of ownership that they are offering people the opportunity to avoid?
There's no doubt that some of them are coming up against regulations. I think, you know, Milo's right to a certain extent that regulations exist to protect people. But very specifically, they're often designed to protect people who are part of entrenched interests. So, for example, you have something like Uber that's going up against the cab lobby and all of these
And Uber does what? Tell our listeners.
Uber is basically a company that makes it easier for people to get rides in cities, to get cabs within cities.
So it's like rideshare, the same kind of thing as that.
And they essentially are coming up against regulations that limit the number of taxi cab medallions. Designed initially to protect the wages of taxi drivers, and I'm a fan of livable wages, absolutely. But there's a reason why you can't get a taxi in a lot of these big cities, and it's because the laws exist to limit the number of taxis. And Uber is this innovation, this capitalist innovation, that says, you know what? No, there's a better way for people to get taxis. There's some of these regulations are not protecting capitalism; they are hurting consumers. And I think that the fact that the hotel lobby has tried to shut down some Airbnb projects as well is also a part of this entrenched self-interest that the sharing economy is butting up against. So I do think that this is a new movement, this peer-to-peer economy, and it's been accelerated by the twin forces of the Great Recession, which has limited people's budgets and made them more likely to seek sharing economy solutions to problems like transportation and staying and housing. And at the same time, the rise of the internet and the rise of mobile internet has created this challenge for current regulations that I think, as somebody else said, maybe it was April or Anna, you know, you have a lot of laws that were written and designed to protect a ownership economy, and we're moving a little bit beyond that. And I think the laws should reflect the fact that we're moving beyond that.
So what about that, Milo Yiannopoulos? We hear so often about special interests that have co-opted one government or another to make rules that are favorable to it and unfavorable to its competitors. Isn't it good to get away from that?
I'm not sure that I agree with the basis of the question. I mean, if you look at the the campaigning that's done on behalf of consumer rights and consumer interests by lawmakers pretty much everywhere, I'd say, you know, there's a pretty even-handed, it's a pretty equal kind of balance of priorities from the point of view of our lawmakers. You know, on the one hand, you have certain parties that tend to, you know, protect their buddies with money. On the other, you have parties that tend to stick up for consumer rights, and that, you know, the precise combination of that can be quite complicated, and depends from, you know, from country to country. But I don't really accept the basis of the question that, you know, in the most part, regulation exists to protect consumers and does it really well. And when you get a company that's, you know, that wants to dodge that regulation or wants to ignore it or wants to, you know, to stick two fingers up at it, there's a very clear reason why they want to do that. It's because they want to make a quick buck. And when they make a quick buck, they cut corners. They make people unsafe. And you know, you only need to look at the financial architecture of Silicon Valley businesses to understand, you know, what they're for.
Very quickly, we're almost out of time, but I have to ask April Rennie this question. There is a company that helps you share your leftovers. It's called Cookening. Helps you find people to eat your food when you have more than you need. How do we know that's a safe thing to do?
Well, that's, I think, part of a larger phenomenon, which I would term broadly social eating. And in terms of people that want to actually share, going back to what Derek was saying at the very beginning, it's sort of idling capacity, if you will, but excess. We're living in a world where resources are finite and people are searching for ways to do things with one another better and more efficiently, including social experiences. So I must admit, I'm not aware of a single incidence on Cookening, on Feastly, or on any one of dozens of other eating platforms of malintent. It's a much more of a social function where people are connecting and being able to do things in shared fashion, if you will, that are good for the economy, good for the environment, and good for community. So that's probably all I can say with limited time.
Okay. I'm sorry about the time limits, but that is the tyranny that we live with on the radio. I want to thank all of you for being with us. It's been a very interesting conversation. Again, April Rennie is Chief Strategy Officer at the Collaborative Lab, which works worldwide to help governments and companies understand the potential of what's called collaborative consumption. Milo Yiannopoulos at the online tech magazine The Kernel, who thinks all this is nuts, if I may be so brief. Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, senior editor overseeing business coverage for TheAtlantic.com, and Anna Bernasek, author of Economics of Integrity, who writes the Data Points column at The New York Times. Great to have all of you on our program. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll come back to the idea of the sharing economy on future programs. Three-time MVP Alex Rodriguez may not be banned from baseball for all time, but reportedly he is negotiating over a very lengthy suspension and a substantial fine. We'll hear more about the baseball crackdown on drugs in a moment on To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. Alex Rodriguez is at the center of baseball's latest drug scandal. It involves the anti-aging clinic called Biogenesis. We've heard about that on our program. Bob Nightingale is Major League Baseball columnist at USA Today. Good to have you on our program.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Is there a real possibility that Alex Rodriguez, of all people, three-time MVP, might end up like Lance Armstrong with a lifetime ban from the sport that he has almost become synonymous with?
Well,
Major League Baseball is going to try to impose a lifetime ban if he doesn't accept lesser punishment. Right now they're saying you can miss the rest of this season and sit out all through 2014, and we won't impose a lifetime ban. If you choose not to do so, we may impose this, and you have to fight that with in front of an arbitrator or a court system.
What about the money involved?
Well, if he misses the rest of this year in 2014, he'll be out about $36.5 million. But after that, he still has $60 million left through three more years. So he still has five more years left in his contract. So if he wants to protect the $60 million, MLB is telling him you should accept the suspension now.
As this arbitration process goes on, is there a possibility that there might be more evidence against Alex Rodriguez?
Well, the trouble he might face now is for the first time the federal agency is looking at the Biogenesis Clinic. Before, they weren't interested at all, but it turns out the Biogenesis Clinic for selling steroids to underage kids. So now the federal government is involved. That means there could be subpoenas, and that could mean trouble for Alex Rodriguez, where he'd now have to sit in court and testify what exactly he's done with Biogenesis and what other clients he knows that frequent in the place.
Elaborate on that. What do we know about Biogenesis so far?
Well, it was a clinic. You know, it wasn't as big as Balco, but very big in South Florida, just a wellness clinic. It prescribed HGH, steroids, other assorted drugs to all sorts of athletes, baseball, basketball, hockey, you know, gymnastics, you name it. And so it was a place where people kind of went in there to get either patches of testosterone or even a thing called gummy bears where you'd actually put it underneath your tongue, and what would happen, that would give you a rush of testosterone. So people were able to beat the testing system by doing this stuff. Then finally, it got shut down in November, December, and one of the disgruntled employees leaked that information to an alternative newspaper called the Miami New Times, and that kind of broke open the case.
You mentioned DeBalco. That was the one in the Bay Area near San Francisco where Barry Bonds got in trouble.
Exactly, and in particular, the track stars, you know, like Marion Jones and bicyclists, everybody else. That was Victor Conte's lab and very high-tech stuff. And this was more of a lower version of it. But the guys that were taking it, there was absolutely no trace to be found.
So then again, Alex Rodriguez might face a lifetime ban if he's not willing to take this lesser punishment of giving up the rest of this season and next season as well. Are there others who are facing draconian penalties, if that's what these are, as well as he?
Well, Ryan Braun accepted a 65-game suspension through this season. So that's been the biggest suspension so far. The rest of the suspensions could be between 12 and 15 players, which should be 50 games, which is a first-time offense. Why they're going so hard after Alex Rodriguez, even though he's never tested positive, is that they believe he's been lying consistently over the years about taking steroids, and also that he impeded the investigation. He actually so get him almost an obstruction of justice charge as far as their investigation and harassing witnesses and that sort of thing. That's why they might impose a lifetime ban.
On the other hand, if he's never tested positive, isn't there still a reasonable doubt?
There is, except for the fact, you know, just like Ryan Braun never tested positive either in this case, but those names were littered throughout the Biogenesis records. Tony Bosch, the director of that clinic, is testifying for Major League Baseball and giving them all the evidence. So Alex Rodriguez's name showed up 16 times in the documents with scheduled doping records, injections, everything else that he allegedly did over the last few years. And the clinic director, Tony Bosch, is saying he did all this stuff, and I'll testify in court that he did this.
Again, you mentioned Ryan Braun a couple of times with the Milwaukee Brewers. Was he also involved with Biogenesis in Miami?
Yes, that's why they got him for 65 games. Same type of thing. He tested positive a couple of years ago by Major League Baseball, but beat it in an appeal to a technicality. In this case, it was strictly Biogenesis, and he decided, I'll serve my suspension now to get it out of the way before the 2014 season. So Alex Rodriguez will get the stiffest penalty, Braun the second biggest, and the rest should all be 50 games.
What does all this mean for the business of baseball? It's doing pretty well at the moment. People come to see Alex Rodriguez and Ryan Braun. How do the owners justify this crackdown, do you think, in terms of what it costs them in terms of the bottom line?
No, I mean, it's a great question because they've spent tens of millions of dollars in this investigation. They've spent more money in this investigation than every investigation of baseball combined. What they're trying to tell the fans and even the other players, we want a clean sport. We'll do everything possible. If you cheat, we'll catch you. So even though it may hurt them now, they think they'll be much better off in the long run. Yeah, let's face it, baseball's still thriving. They're expected to have a record $8.5 billion in revenues this year.
There are those who say that a clean sport is a pipe dream, that for every new test that is devised, there will be a new drug that can overcome the test. Is anybody really shocked by this?
They shouldn't be. I mean, I think a few years ago it said, the steroid era is over. Well, it's not over, and you're exactly right. There'll always be smarter chemists and scientists to think of a better drug. You know, baseball became the first sport to actually implement blood testing. So now players are blood tested, so that makes it a lot tougher, too, to cheat. But you're right. It'll never be 100% clean. No sport ever will be.
But going after Alex Rodriguez, prominent and important as he is in the sport, that certainly sends a message to the other players.
It really does. And this is the first time we've seen a complete culture change among players. When Ryan Braun was caught, players lashed out at him vociferously, saying, we can't believe he did this. He lied to us. We want him banned forever. And so the same thing's going to happen to Alex Rodriguez. The players do want a clean sport before. It's okay. Almost like everybody turned their back. Not anymore.
Bob Nightingale, Major League Baseball columnist, USA Today. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
To the Point, produced this week by Christian Bordahl, Carrie Cavanaugh, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Anna Scott, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport, managing producer Sonia Geis. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI. Public Radio International.